Hello, I'm Ross Cammage, and welcome to How This Is Building Me, a podcast focused on the highs and lows, ups and downs of all those involved with cancer, cancer medicine, and cancer science. And I thought we'd start to delve into the idea of how cancer ideas were communicated to people. And for that and several other reasons, I'm very excited that my first guest is Jeff White. Jeff, would you care to introduce yourself in any way that you see fit?
My name is Jeff White, and I am a recent head and neck cancer patient. And one of the unique elements of this is that I actually work in cancer communications. So I am the director of public relations for the American Society for Radiation Oncology and have been working in the space for the last 6 years. And so the fact that I was diagnosed with cancer while working here has kind of created a unique opportunity for me to use my communication skills and kind of share my experience.
That's a great glass half full approach to life. Let's go back to the beginning. So how does someone become a communications expert? Maybe that's the wrong title, but I mean, your undergraduate degree was in marketing. But again, let's go back to the young Jeff White. When you go, yes, marketing, that's what I want to do.
Communications has always been kind of one of my strong suits. My first job out of college was working in marketing for a corporation in San Francisco. And I just kind of honed my skills a little bit and kind of was able to identify, you know, areas that were most interesting to me. And that was kind of making sure that the audience that we were talking to kind of understood, you know, more about the work we were doing. And as my career advanced, you know, you kind of learn about wanting to ensure that you're spending your time working on something that you care about. So I feel like my career really has been about ever so slightly fine-tuning and defining kind of how I want to spend my time. And so I worked in the corporate sector for 12 years on products that to be honest, I didn't really care about. And so I transitioned from that to working in PR. And I transitioned to Ogilvy Public Relations, where I was able to work on national healthcare campaigns. And so that was kind of the first time that I was like, okay, now I'm using my skills for something that I feel more connected to. And so my clients, you know, were federal government. So I worked, you know, on behalf of the CDC and the NIH, kind of helping them with their public health education campaigns.
That's an impressive transition, because let's be honest, we've all seen Mad Men. You know, the idea of marketing is about, I'm going to sell something,
right?
Whether it's good or bad, you know, and then you have a sort of a, was it an epiphany or was it kind of a gradual drift?
There was definitely some moments in my career. Literally one of them was I was working for a Fortune 500 company here in the DC area and was just miserable. Like, I was making great money, interesting travel, but I just didn't care about kind of the services we were offering. And my father was a stockbroker for 45 years with Merrill Lynch. So he was one of their longest tenured employees ever. And I went and talked to him and I said, Dad, I'm just so unhappy. I'd really like to just give notice. I don't know what I want to do, but I just don't want to do this. And he was shockingly supportive.
Oh, that's fantastic.
You know, he was like, I had kids. So he's like, I didn't have that luxury, but he's like, you should do that. And I went back and went in to give notice. And my boss is like, before you tell me what you're going to tell me, he's like, can I ask you a quick favor? Can you take my position? Because I just got promoted and I need you to step in for me in my role. And I ended up not giving notice and I ended up staying a little bit longer just to help him because he was a great guy. But ultimately, once we got settled, then I stepped away.
I like that. It's like, I want to quit or just be promoted. And yeah, it's like, okay, I'll take the promotion.
Unbelievable. Yeah. So, you know, they ended up getting bought out and I was like, I don't want to work for the new company. So I did quit before the merger with nothing. Like, no, I had no plan, which, you know, in hindsight probably wasn't the smartest, but it did allow me to kind of stretch my wings a little bit, kind of use my networking, and ultimately landed at Ogilvy, which was great.
It's interesting to draw it's a kind of dotted line between marketing and public relations. So you're still selling something, but it's not a product. It's an idea or a message.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
How do you measure success? Because there's not like units sold.
Mm-hmm. Well, for us, you know, this was about, you know, awareness. So it was awareness building around issues. I worked on an HIV awareness campaign for the workplace. Because at the time, you know, this is in the 90s, you know, workers were getting let go if they disclosed that they had HIV. And, you know, the fear was so high and the workplaces didn't know how to deal with it. They didn't know how to, you know, meet the needs of folks, you know, living with HIV. So it was a whole campaign around educating businesses and labor unions around how you can create a workplace that is supportive for your employees that have, in this case, HIV, but any sort of, you know, illness that they're living with.
So you start off with the CDC on kind of, sounds like, infectious diseases. I think I saw a segue into, you know, teen HIV as well. Was it always healthcare? Is that what you kind of, like, that became your thing?
I worked on a number of different campaigns, and I ultimately went to a mid-sized PR firm for 5 years, and I worked in the association and nonprofit sector. So I worked on issues, you know, including healthcare issues, but I worked on education issues, hunger issues, literacy. So I was able to work on a number of different, very interesting issues that I love, but it was hard. You're working for five different clients, so you have to be an expert in five different sectors. And that's hard. That's a lot of work and it's exhausting. So ultimately, I was like, I'd like to go in-house. I'd like to focus on, you know, one or two core issues so that I can really become, you know, more of the subject matter expert that I want to be. And that's where I landed in healthcare.
Do you ever get, like, you're in a war with someone trying to push out a different message? I mean, is there a PR company pushing out an opposing message and you're competing? Or is it like, there's a desert and there's no information and you're, you know, the one oasis that says, look, here's some facts?
I would say it's not so much about competition, but it's really managing your clients' expectations of what's possible and kind of what's the best way to do it. And, you know, in my PR days, in the old days, it was always, what's your measure of success? And it was, we want to be on Oprah. So Oprah was always the gold standard. And every client, no matter what their issue was, said, you know, we want to be on Oprah. And that's where you have to be like, well, you know, I get it, but that's really not going to, you know, that's not really where your audience is, let's say.
Yeah.
Or there's another way to define success for you. And that's where you have to kind of work with them to figure that out.
Where did Astro come calling, or did you go knock on the door of Astro?
I knocked on the door of Astro, and I live in Washington, D.C., which is, you know, such a networking town. And I would say every position I've ever had, I had some sort of connection with somebody within an organization. And this was one of the only times, like, I didn't know anybody there, but what they were looking for as far as kind of raising the awareness about, you know, radiation oncology, radiation therapy to treat cancer kind of fit with the model that I had, because I had prior to that helped the Hitachi Foundation sunset their foundation. So they were on a 3-year sunset campaign. And so I helped them. And they also had a healthcare focus as well, but I kind of helped them kind of identify what's a win for them as far as getting awareness about the issues that they care about, including workers' healthcare systems. And it just kind of fit in the same model for Astro, because they were looking for, they wanted to build up their awareness around radiation therapy. And also, you know, that their physicians felt like they had a voice, you know, in the patient space as well. There are different ways to treat cancer. There's surgery, there's chemotherapy, and there's radiation therapy. So they wanted to make sure that their treatment options were being shared with patients as well.
Let me pick up on a couple of terms that I didn't really understand. So first of all, what's the Hitachi Foundation and what's sunsetting in this context?
So the Hitachi Foundation was a foundation started by Hitachi Corporation, the Japanese company. At that point, it was 30 years old. And they had come to the United States, you know, kind of in a goodwill gesture, because they wanted to become a good corporate partner in the United States. But they had decided that they wanted to go out kind of with a bang. They had funds that they wanted to distribute. The board had decided that they were ready to kind of end their run. And the Hitachi Corporation in Japan had said, you know, we're ready to kind of sunset this foundation in the United States. We want to bring everything back to Japan, and we're going to run our foundation out of Japan instead of the United States. So they had given them a runway to say, you've got 3 years to kind of and your programs. But the board had said, fine, we'll do that, but we want to make sure we're going out as strong as we can, help as many, you know, grantees as we can and things like that. So they needed some help on the PR side.
So that was one where you're in a job and, mm-hmm. you know there's an expiry date on the job.
Correct. Yep.
How did ASTRO? So ASTRO is the American Society of
Radiation Oncology.
What does the T stand for?
So the T used to stand for therapeutic.
Okay.
But they did a rebranding a few years prior to me joining. They kept, everybody kind of knew it as ASTRO, but they got rid of therapeutic because they felt like it was a little.
So it's really funny. ASTRO?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I can see why they kept the T.
Yeah.
Now, how did they find you?
I found them. They had posted the position, you know, in a number of listservs in the DC area. And I just submitted my resume and got a call, I think within the next day, frankly, they called.
Had there been someone in the position before?
No, it was a brand new position.
And so what is it, director of communications?
It's director of public relations and strategic communications.
And so that's fantastic. So you go in, complete blank slate.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how do you start?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, do you go in and just go like, you guys are all complete idiots and you didn't do anything wrong and listen to me, or you have to go softly. I mean, what's the approach?
I'm glad you asked this question because I very specifically went in a different way, because as a PR person, you kind of want to come in with, here are the answers. Here's what you need to do. You got to do this, this, and this, and this will happen for you.
Yeah.
I chose a different route in my conversations with them because while I had a sense of what they needed, I also recognized I needed to talk to people within the organization. I needed to talk to their stakeholders. For me, I felt like I took a gamble and I said, I'm not going to give you the answer during my interview about what I think you need to do. I said, I really want you to give me time to talk to people. And I want to do stakeholder interviews, you know, for the first 90 days of my time there to really get a sense of what the need is. They agreed to it. And so, you know, I started and just did tons of, you know, in-person and telephone calls with folks just to get an understanding of what the priorities were. And then I came up with a plan for them that I presented to the board a couple of months later.
I mean, I think that's brilliant. It's kind of like, you know, you just have to trust me and I'm not going to give you the answers now, but I've got the skill set and, you know, invest in me and then something great will happen.
Yeah.
Let's just try and explain what ASTRO is to an audience that may not be familiar with the organization.
Sure. ASTRO is a membership association, and our members are radiation oncologists as well as other members of the radiation oncology team, dosimetrists and therapists and things like that. Their goal is to become educated. You know, it's a membership association is about member education. It's about, you know, kind of our annual meeting. So you want to get together, you want to understand the latest science. So it's about sharing research that's happening within the field, as well as, you know, we have a journals program where, you know, you can, the physicians and the members can submit articles to what we call the Red Journal, the journal for our specialty, where they're sharing the latest science and advances in radiation therapy as a treatment for cancer.
Is your primary audience the membership? Correct. Or is your product what the membership produces and you're pushing it out to an external audience, or both?
So we have both. We are a membership association, so my primary commitment is to our members so that they feel that they are being heard, or that, you know, that the information that the association is sharing gets out to as many of the members as possible. In the same vein, there is a patient education component to what ASTRO does. We have a separate website called RT Answers, RT Radiation Therapy Answers, and that is, you know, a public-facing website with videos and brochures that go through the different types of cancers that, you know, patients are dealing with, and then kind of what your treatment options are, what treatment is going to be like for you, side effects and things like that.
You know, I'm medically trained. You're no one, although you work in the healthcare field. Mm-hmm. Do you have to, like, feeding from the fire hose when you start? I mean, that's an awful, I mean, you're throwing around these terms very confidently now because, you know, you've clearly learned all of this, but that must have been quite a steep learning curve.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And I think that's kind of the reason I gave myself, you know, a little bit of a window of education too, because I recognized, you know, this is a very technical specialty as well. And I wanted to have a better understanding of, you know, how the technology worked, not recognizing that at some point I was actually going to use this technology for my own health.
Well, I was going to get to that. So prior to you actually being on the receiving end of the radiation, did they sort of show you around a linear accelerator and radiation suites, or was it all theoretical?
They do a really nice job of onboarding new employees, including, you know, going to visit, you know, facilities within the Metro DC area. So I went to a couple of different hospitals. I went to George Washington and I went to Inova just to, you know, they kind of gave us tours, as well as when we, you know, we have our annual meeting, we have a gigantic, you know, exhibit hall that has all the latest technology. And so, you know, some of our member doctors will take us around the exhibit hall to show us, you know, this is the latest and greatest in the technology in the space.
That's pretty cool. You take over this new position. Presumably some degree of communication is already going on. Mm-hmm. I mean, there were, you know, people were tweeting, doing social media, doing emails, you know, maybe there was a website. So again, where do you fit in?
Yeah, that's an important question. I came in as an external communications person. So there was already an extensive member communications team in place. So I was, they have all sorts of mechanisms for communicating with the members, from emails to the website and things like that. So that was already established. My job was really thinking about externally, you know, how are we talking to the patient population? How are we talking to the media? And they did attach me with the social media component too. So while we had a social media presence, and this was, you know, 2017, you know, we had opportunities for growth in social media, and at least I had some experience in that in my PR background. So I kind of was able to focus on the social media side as well, because our doctors really took to, specifically, they took to Twitter. They loved Twitter.
And well, actually, that's an interesting question. So given the plethora of platforms, does your organization just go for Twitter, or are you having to sort of jump onto every other platform as well?
And this is what I always counsel my clients as well. Like, you want to meet your audience where they are. So I never felt the need to be everywhere, because I feel like if you're everywhere, you're not really doing it well.
Yeah.
So we already had an established presence on Facebook, LinkedIn, and Twitter. And like, our international members tended to like Facebook more, because I don't know why, but they tended to engage with us on Facebook more. We've always done quite well on LinkedIn, and Twitter was kind of an opportunity for growth for us, and we definitely saw that happen.
And presumably they have slightly different parameters that you can push out into different ones. So do you try and like take the same message and push it out, you know, just edit it down, or is it kind of like you have a totally different strategy for each platform?
They're fairly similar. It's just what it tends to be, kind of what works better. So like, our journal content does very well on Facebook for some reason, and we've never understood exactly why, but the engagement, you know, if we're putting something about the annual meeting, a journal study, or, you know, patient awareness information, it's the journal stuff that tends to do well with our international audience on Facebook. Twitter is more about, our members tend to be on, our US-based members tend to be on Twitter, and they like to share the latest news and information. So, you know, it's obviously it's shorter content, but our members tend to want to know kind of what's happening in the association through Twitter.
It's funny, one of the observations I've seen is that the medical Twitter seems to actually be a very nice and respectful space, contrary to the perception of sort of Twitter as a cesspool in the general word. And certainly I'm relatively new to Twitter, but if I sort of go off-piste and sort of go there, it's kind of like, whoa, this is scary. I'm just coming back to my little medical group. One of the things I wanted to ask you is, you mentioned it already, that the organization has a journal. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that in a sense is a communication tool, pushing stuff out. Does that fall under your remit? You know, is there a turf war? How did you take that one on?
The journals fall under member communications, so we work with them. Everything is volunteer-based at the membership association as well. So we have volunteer members that work as editors on these journals. And they help us identify, you know, of the studies within this journal, the ones that they think might capture the interest and attention of the membership. So they actually help us decide, this is the study that we think that you should put out on social media. And, you know, they tend to know that audience pretty well. And that's why things do, I think, better for us, that, you know, we as lay people are deciding, you know, because we don't have the expertise.
Does the journal have its own social media account, or is that, does it fall under the main Astro one?
It started out under the Astro banner because Astro runs three different journals. You know, one is a paid subscription journal, one is an open access journal, and then we have a third one as well. And so everything has been under the Astro handle. And, you know, we have 25,000 followers on Twitter. To start a new Twitter account, you know, for a journal, that's hard. That's a hard lift. So while there is a separate one for the Red Journal, you know, they recognize that it's hard for them to kind of get that sort of reach. So they kind of rely on the Astro account.
Got it. By my calculation, you've been in Astro maybe like 7 years, seven or eight years?
Yeah, seven.
Let's delve a little bit into you. When did you transition from cancer expert to cancer patient?
So that was in 2023, and it happened kind of in an innocuous way. And that was, I was in the shower one day and I just felt a lump on my neck, on the right side of my neck. And I remember thinking like, well, that's weird. That I don't remember that yesterday.
Yeah.
But I felt fine, you know, and I had just had a physical with full blood work like 2 months before, and everything was fine. And I didn't really think much of it. And so I had a dermatology appointment, just because as a redhead, I also I have to make sure I get my skin checked every 6 months. And my dermatologist was like, you know, the minute he walked in the door, he's like, what is that on your neck?
Wow.
And I said, oh, I said, I just noticed it the other day. And he's like, well, have you been sick? And I said, yeah, I just am getting over a cold. And he's like, well, that's probably what it is. But, you know, if it's still there in 2 weeks, please call your primary care doctor. And so 2 weeks went by. It had shrunk a little bit, but it was still there. And so I just did what he said, and I called my primary.
Okay, so that's the beginning of the journey.
Mm-hmm.
So when does, you know, Jeff White's brain start to go, hey, work on cancer all day? Maybe these things are connected. Or was that like your brain is kind of like, this is absolutely not cancer. That happens to other people.
Yeah. The other thing that I've told many people, because they would always say, how did you get to work at a cancer organization? And I have said so many times, well, cancer is actually not really something that runs in my family. We have other issues, but cancer is not one of them. So I, to be honest, I was not cancer focused when I went to the doctor at all. I just thought I had a swollen lymph node and I just didn't think much of it. And when I went to go see my doctor, he was not, my primary care doctor that I've been going to for 20 years wasn't in. So I went to see a new physician in the practice, and he started asking me questions, and it just, the level of intensity in the questions was kind of getting me a little nervous.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was asking about weight loss and all these things that I was like, well, no, I haven't lost any weight and I'm sleeping fine and this and that. And I said, what are you thinking? He's like, well, I'm trying to rule out malignant lymphoma. And that was in 5 minutes of me sitting in the chair, and I just, to hear malignant lymphoma within 5 minutes, I mean, I just, it was an out-of-body experience. And and then, you know, we kept talking and talking, and then he finally said, or it could be nothing.
You could have lived with that.
And that's what I said. I was really like, why didn't you lead with that? Like, because I can't, I can barely function at this point.
Okay, so he introduces a huge elephant to the room,
mm-hmm.
pretty big, gray, and scary mm-hmm. at this point. So then does he say, okay, we got to biopsy it?
Mm-hmm.
What happens next?
Yeah, he's like, I really think that you should get an ultrasound and a needle biopsy, and here are names of people to go to. You know, handed me, you know, referrals and sent me on my way.
Does that become something that you go, I need to do this afternoon, or I'll get around to it when I've got my head around it?
I did it literally in the lobby when I started calling. Yeah. I was incredibly stressed. But, you know, here's the thing. They were like, oh, we can see you in 3 weeks. Oh, so wow. I made my first appointment was going to be 3 weeks, you know, away.
And was that acceptable to you?
So, yes, it was.
I think if I'm stressed enough to phone from the lobby, the 3 weeks is like, what? I could be dead by then.
You know? I wasn't worried. I want to take this from the perspective of a patient in the sense of I didn't know any better. I was like, okay, like you gave me these names. These are the people I should see. They're telling me 3 weeks. That's what it's going to be.
Okay.
And it was only because I talked to my boss later that afternoon and kind of shared what was happening. And she said, you should call one of our doctors like right now and see if they can help you.
Well, yeah. I mean, what is the point in working for this huge organization of experts and not making use of it? But although I can understand that takes into mm-hmm. a level of seriousness by doing that.
Mm-hmm. Well, and also, you know, this was an ultrasound, and I guess I wasn't associating an ultrasound with radiation oncology. I just hadn't taken the leap.
Yeah.
Because radiation oncology is truly about cancer. And at that point, I was like, well, it could be nothing. Like, you know, yeah. I was still hopeful of hope. But the thought of sitting for 3 weeks with this, you know, that wasn't going to work. And so I'm so grateful to my boss for saying that, because I was able to call, you know, one of our doctors who I know and have known for years on his cell phone. And he picked up within two rings and he's like, what can I do for you? How can I help you?
Yeah. I mean, it's funny. There are lots of downsides in working on oncology, but I think there is a professional courtesy that we recognize the stress it induces in people. And so if we can do something to help, most oncologists will, you know, fit people into lists and add people mm-hmm. on to make phone calls. So mm-hmm. I'm glad that happened for you.
Yeah, no, I mean, I feel so incredibly grateful. But I also recognize how unique that is for me. So I feel a little bit guilty, but he was able to get me in the next day to get the ultrasound and the biopsy.
And so when did they drop the bomb?
So I go in, get the ultrasound and biopsy, and they're like, oh, it's good news. It's benign. We took a needle biopsy. It's benign. You're good. You know, you have this lump. You know, you may want to go see a surgeon to get the lump removed, but you don't need to. You can live with this. And my stress level went way down. I wasn't feeling super anxious about things, but I thought, well, I should probably just get it taken out. Like, it wasn't a vanity thing, but I was just like, well, you know, I might as well get it taken out. Made an appointment to see a surgeon that my radiation oncologist recommended at another facility here in DC. And, you know, it was a couple of weeks. They're like, we can see you in a couple of weeks. And I was like, that's fine. Yeah, I wasn't feeling any sense of urgency.
Yeah, because they told you it was benign.
Yeah. So I went, and if you're ready for that story, so I went in for that appointment, pretty, you know, easy going, like, hey, how's it going? I just have this little benign cyst. I'd like to get it removed. And the doctor was like, He's like, I don't think that's what that is. He's like, I think you have tonsil cancer. So again, within moments, oof. You know, I sunk into the chair and just like I did before. And was...
Did you push back against that? And you go, look, dude, I've got a biopsy. It says it's benign. Why are you giving me this?
Nope. And I mean, this was the chair of the department of, you know, ear, nose, and throat. And he was pretty serious and he was a very serious person and presented it pretty matter of fact. And he's like, you know, he's like, I could be wrong. He's like, but I have been seeing this a lot in men of your age because I'm 59. And he's like, I suspect that you probably have something on your tonsil. So I'd like to do a biopsy of that.
So, okay. So he said, we got to biopsy a different bit of you.
Mm-hmm. Yep. That was going to be a surgical procedure. So we had to book that.
What are we talking now? We're talking 2 months, 3 months from the original lump in the shower?
It'd be, about 2 months.
Okay. So was it that procedure that then made the diagnosis?
Yeah. So the surgical biopsy, and this was another thing where, you know, it was scheduled for a week from that particular appointment. So I had to sit with it for a week. It was such an interesting mind game of not wanting it to be cancer, not wanting it, trying to fight it. And ultimately, before I went in, I was like, I think he's probably right. Like, this guy's amazing. Like, I trusted his expertise. So I kind of went in with the expectation that he was going to say it was cancer. So I kind of went in surprisingly calm, I would say.
Were you starting to do research in what head and neck cancer was at this point? Was Dr. Google your new friend?
No, not at all. Not at all. No. And so I learned my lesson. Again, I've had some issues with skin cancer, including melanoma, 10 years prior. And I had been caught by Dr. Google, who told me that my melanoma was, you know, going to end my life. And again, this was 10 years ago, but it was American Cancer Society. There are no strong treatments for melanoma. Get your affairs in order. I mean, it was a really traumatic experience, and it happened over a Thanksgiving weekend. So I got the call on a Wednesday before Thanksgiving at 3 o'clock, you know, and then the doctor left for the holiday. So I had to sit with this. So I learned my lesson to not do that. And I had other people that could do some research for me, and I trusted them.
Okay. So you get your operation, they say it's cancer, and then, mm-hmm. but that wasn't a definitive operation. That was just to make the diagnosis.
Correct. Mm-hmm.
So yeah. Then they're getting, okay, Mr. White, so, you know, we know it actually is cancer. You're working for, you know, one of the world's largest radiation oncology organizations,
mm-hmm.
but your person making the diagnosis is a surgeon. So there's always this dichotomy in head and neck cancers as to, do the surgeons jump in first? Do the radiation oncologists jump in first? How did you square that circle?
Well, the good news was he felt like it was early stage. So he was keeping me relatively calm that he thought it was going to be early stage. And when he did the biopsy, he's like, it looks early stage. So that kind of helped me stay calm. And I liked the idea of it being removed. Like I, you know, excising something and getting it out of my body was appealing to me. And he was like, you know, if the margins are clear, you'll have, you know, a course of radiation and then you'll be good to go. So it was, okay. I was pretty straightforward. And, you know, and then there were questions about, you know, but we have to look at your lymph nodes as well. And, you know, we'll have to take a look and see how those are looking to decide kind of what your ultimate course of treatment is.
I mean, this is audio, but you don't look like you had some of the disfiguring surgery that some people unfortunately have to go through with head and neck cancer. You look completely normal to me. Hopefully that was the case. You're wearing an open neck shirt and you have a big scar halfway down your neck.
Yeah. I mean, I do have a scar, but it's like he did it kind of in the right spot. So yeah.
Good job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've gotten a lot of compliments on my scar. And I honestly did not care in the least. I didn't even ask a question about scarring. I was like, I don't care. Just get it out of me. Just do whatever you need to do and I'll deal with it. But I'm not a vain person. So I was like, I'll deal with whatever. And so I was happily surprised that it kind of fit within my neckline.
So given your job is surrounded by radiation oncologists, mm-hmm. were you kind of keeping this away from them? I mean, you maybe grabbed a few people in the corridor for some help, mm-hmm. but when did you go, quote-unquote, public with this? Maybe there was an artificial line in the road. Maybe you were public from the beginning.
So, yeah, I mean, there were definitely stages to it. I mean, I certainly told, you know, some of the people within my office that were closer to me, you know, kind of what was happening. Because I was gone a lot. I was running to appointments and so many different sort of scans and things like that. But, you know, I wanted to really, you know, have a good understanding of kind of what my path was going to be. So, like, I didn't tell my team until I really knew, like, here's your surgery date. Yeah, this is what's going to happen. And then you're going to, you know, rest for a while. And then you're going to have your radiation. So, but I also thought, you know, I'm a healthcare communicator. This is a ridiculous experience. And kind of, it is an opportunity to share with a broader audience, especially, you know, within our membership of radiation oncologists, kind of what's happening. So that's when I decided that I was okay going public on Twitter with what was happening to me, because I felt an obligation to use this for public good.
Yeah, no, I could see that. So how do you do that first tweet that sort of announces to the world? That's got to be a tough one in whatever the character limit is.
Mm-hmm. Well, I did it in a thread. So I did a series of tweets because I recognized that, you couldn't really do this in the number of characters allowed. And yeah, I just kind of did an announcement in a series. I think it was 8 or 10 tweets together where I just kind of shared kind of what the experience had been up to that point of the surgery.
And what was the reaction?
It was overwhelmingly supportive and positive. Our doctors are so kind and have always been so kind to the staff here, but the outpouring of support that I got really filled me up in a way that I needed. I'm a people person, and I get energy from being with people. And so recognizing that I would be stepping away for a bit, you know, kind of having to focus on myself, which was a new experience, but I also needed some sort of connection to folks. And I definitely got that through social media.
And so, you know, this is fairly recent. So the radiation is still ongoing, or you finished it?
I finished it. So the surgery was last August. So August 15th was my surgery. And then we were scheduled to start radiation. Oh, and the other wrinkle was, so when I went in for my pathology after my surgery, I went in again pretty blasé about it, because I was like, you know, they took out the tonsil, they did a neck dissection to check my lymph nodes. And I went in and I was like, they're not going to tell me I have cancer again. So I went in pretty optimistic. And my best friend here at work is a licensed dosimetrist. Yeah. And so she actually accompanied me to the majority of my meetings and my appointments, because I was having a hard time understanding what was being said to me, even though I worked within the cancer space. It was out of body for me. Yeah. And I just couldn't comprehend. And my partner, you know, has no experience with cancer, and he would just kind of go blank as well. So having my coworker with me was so incredibly helpful, because she could interpret what the doctors were saying. So I owe her so much. She's the one that had to tell me that the biopsy was cancer. Like, she's the one that told me, not my doctor. And hearing it from her was helpful.
That's fascinating insights. You know, I don't want to oversell this, but I can imagine that there's a real positive side to this for a person who works in communication to have gone through this and recognize both the good and the bad at communication that you experienced. Mm-hmm.
Yes. And I will be honest, like, thinking about this conversation with you and recognizing that your audience, you know, is a physician audience, I really want to emphasize that, you know, words matter, and just the slightest word change can mean so much to a patient in a positive way or a negative way. We interpret things in a way that it's hard to describe. I consider myself a very rational person, but if I hear a certain thing, I might interpret it differently than you as a doctor might intend. And that's happened to me a couple of times where I just kind of spiraled and was like, why did they say that word and not this word?
Can you give me an example?
The most recent one was unrelated to this head and neck cancer. They also found a mass on my pelvis. And so I had that removed a few weeks ago. But my radiation oncologist was so kind and called me, and it was just like, how are you doing? Just, you know, I talked to your urologist, and, you know, it sounds like it went well, but we have to wait for the pathology. And, you know, if it is something, we'll figure out a treatment for it, you know, blah, blah, blah. So what I heard was that the two doctors were talking separately, and that they were trying to decide, you know, am I going to have some sort of treatment? Whereas what had been presented to me was, we got it, we excised it, you should be good to go, but we have to wait for the pathology. And I had a full-blown panic attack because I was like, are they having a different conversation with each other than they are with me? And I literally hung up the phone and started shaking. I was in a hospital bed and I was shaking. But, you know, I know my radiation oncologist well enough that I could call him back 5 minutes later and say, I'm freaking out because what you just said has me thinking that you two are having a different conversation. And he had to reassure me. He's like, I promise you we didn't. He's like, all we talked about was it was excised. It looked clean. We're waiting for pathology. And that calmed me down.
I want to give you an example just from my client the other week, and not really about person-to-person communication, but timing of communication. So we normally, there's this thing called the 21st Century Cures Act that as soon as your CT scan is reported, boom, it has to be released onto the patient.
I hate it. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, so what had happened is that, you know, the patients had gotten very used to this. And then the law hadn't changed, but what happened was our staffing level in radiology had changed. So they went from pushing it out in 24 hours to pushing it out in 36 hours.
Mm-hmm.
So when that first happened, all the patients were freaking out that we were holding onto the data because there was something bad going on. Mm-hmm. And you go, no, it's they haven't reported it yet because they still have to release it, you know, mm-hmm. straight away. And yeah, I mean, we're all human and our mind plays tricks with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that exactly happened to me with this mass on my stomach because I had an MRI and it took 5 days to get my results. 5 days.
Yeah.
You know, when I'm used to getting it like the next day. And I did the same thing. I was panicking because I was like, are they rerunning it? What's happening?
Why? Well, they're sitting in a room going, how are we going to break the news to?
Yeah. You know? Yeah. That's exactly what I thought.
We evolve over time. Have you had some immediate and tangible change in how you think communication should be going on at Astro because of your own experiences? Or are you planning to, you know, take that patient voice, which you're already one voice, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Your experiences are unique to you,
mm-hmm.
but also you're now more conscious of the patient voice. Mm-hmm. You know, is that going to help shape the policy? Right, that's a loaded question, isn't it? You know?
Yeah, it's not going to shape the pot. I think it's going to shape and give insight to our volunteer physicians as we work on our patient education materials. You know, I've already noticed a couple of things where I was like, well, you know, you might want to change this language a little bit. So I don't think I'm the be-all, end-all, but my insights are definitely different. I look at our patient education website much differently and think about the fear and think about the fact that I had so much knowledge going in, yet it kind of went out the window a little bit.
Yeah.
When it was myself, because you become a different person. You become so dependent on your team, you know, for everybody from the nurse to the physician to the techs. You really rely on them to keep you as sane as possible.
So there's the Mike Tyson quote, isn't it? That everyone has a plan until you get punched in the face.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, then just goes out of the window.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one of the other things is you're still kind of relatively early in this journey. Let's assume this is all cured. And trying to think if the best option is that Jeff goes from the guy who had cancer that was the headline and is doing his job and blah, 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 to, oh, yeah, by the way, you know, I had cancer. Or, you know, does this have to be front and center, you know, for the rest of your life, your career? Like, hi, I'm Jeff. I have cancer. Now, let's talk about the job. I mean, so have you thought about how you're going to frame that little piece of your narrative going forward?
To be honest, no, I haven't figured that out yet. I feel so fortunate that my cancer was caught early. And while it was a challenging experience and, you know, I was getting to the point too where they threw in chemotherapy because my lymph nodes didn't come out perfect. So that was the other thing where I went into this meeting kind of open with an open heart. And they were like, oh, by the way, you're good.
Well, I love your optimism. It's like, you know, it's all going to be great every time.
Yeah.
You're the Charlie Brown with the football.
Yeah.
It's like very good. Mm-hmm. And then Lucy pulls it away every time.
I did. I feel like that happened to me multiple times. So, yeah, that was a hard one. I really struggled when they told me I had to have chemo. Really struggled with that.
The idea of chemo or the actual experience of chemo, or both?
Both.
Okay.
Yeah. And I didn't know as much about chemo. I knew more about radiation. And, you know, I will be honest, I also knew that head and neck cancer treatment was brutal. Like, and there were many a time in the past few years where I had said to myself silently, I really don't want to ever get head and neck cancer because that treatment is rough.
And yet there you are. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, when junior docs are training and they're going through oncology and they're only seeing inpatients, they think oncology is like all doom and gloom because they don't see the 90% of patients that are happily living a normal life. And just in the outpatient setting, you're really standing up and saying, look, there's a spectrum. And mm-hmm. I'm at one end of the spectrum and, mm-hmm. you know, I'm pretty lucky.
My doctors, as I would do my, you know, weekly check-ins or whatever, would ask me, you know, how are you doing with this and that and eating and all that. And they would just be like, gosh, you're doing amazing. What do I know? Like, I've never done this before. Like, I'm like, I am? Like,
well, it's like, not like there's a choice. It's like, yeah, you're doing as you're doing, you know?
Right, exactly. Yeah, you just kind of have to do it and just kind of see what happens.
So, Jeff, this has been really interesting. And obviously, after a diagnosis of cancer, you know, the future is always a little uncertain. But let's be optimistic, because I think you are an inherently optimistic person. What would you like the next 5 years to bring for Jeff White, both personally and professionally?
I will be honest that I haven't been able to look ahead. I've been so day-to-day. And, you know, there were a lot of people that were saying, oh, you should plan, you know, vacation, you should plan this. I couldn't think ahead. I was so focused on what was happening today, what was the plan for tomorrow. So I still haven't quite wrapped my head around the future and this, you know, the fact that I had this, you know, unexpected surgery 3 weeks ago threw me off as well. So I'm hoping that, you know, my health will continue. I've got a lot of scans ahead of me, and those are going to bring a lot of anxiety. Scanxiety is real.
Yeah.
I mean, it really, the first PET scan was terrifying to me because I was like, what are they going to find? And obviously they found something. And I'm thankful for it. I'm thankful because I think about, like, well, not that many people get PET scans, you know, in a day-to-day. It's not part of a routine treatments plan. So I'm thankful that they found it. I'm thankful that it was taken out. I'm thankful that it was benign. I'm hoping that my experience, you know, will help patients, because I feel like, you know, there are new patients coming into this space every day. And we can't forget that while we have amassed some knowledge around cancer treatments and all the advances, the patients that are just being diagnosed today probably haven't even looked at anything related to cancer up to that point. So we have to remind ourselves that we've got to give them the information in a way that they can accept and understand. And it has to be a gradual process too, because I felt like there was so much information thrown at me that I would lose it after 15 minutes. Like after 15 minutes, I was like, I'm not hearing anything. And I'm thankful that I taped a number of my appointments and I played them back and I'd be like, I do not remember that conversation at all.
Wow.
You know, and that's the other thing. I feel like doctors need to think about, you know, how much information they're giving us at a time, because it's just overwhelming.
Yeah. You give me a really interesting idea. Is I feel there's a huge gap in the market that when the physicians order the scan, that we don't also say, you know, and here's not just the information about what having a CT scan is, but here's the paragraph that talks about scanxiety, mm-hmm. or, you know, just getting that front and center and not just, you know, plowing people on a treadmill and says, okay, right, here's your next scan, right, just deal with it yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, because that's routine for the doctor. This is not routine for the patient.
Yeah, that's a great point. Okay, so what about in your job, in your private life, where would you like to be in 5 years' time? Would you like to be going on these vacations and doing everything else?
I'd like my mind to rest a little bit. I feel like my mind's been kind of working over time. But I would like the opportunity to share my experience with whatever audience is interested in a way that helps patients. I think that, you know, I would feel gratified if I could get something positive out of it. And this, you know, podcast is a great opportunity I didn't want to pass up, because I do feel like it's a unique situation, but I want to help as many patients as possible.
Jeff, thanks for sharing your story with us.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
You've been listening to How This Is Building Me with me, Ross Kamage. rate us and review us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, or follow us at DrKamage on X for additional commentary.